Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Bwahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast. My name is Tiagi Delanrol, and I'm your host today. I'll be joined today by Sasha Farley, CEO of Sasha Farley Consulting, human-centered leadership and organizational development consultant, who believes that people are at the heart of every successful company. With her experience at Booz Allen Hamilton, Sasha has, across government, corporate, and nonprofit sectors, bring deep expertise in neuro-based leadership development, culture transformation, and energizing retreat facilitation to help leaders create workplaces that drive both business success and human flourishing. In this episode, we'll explore how to lead change in a way that empowers people rather than overwhelming them, the importance of emotional intelligence and trust in high-performing organizations, and lessons from human-first transformation initiatives, and why culture always comes before strategy. Welcome, Sasha.
Thank you. It's so excited to be here.
Great. We're so excited to have you. And, you know, here at the Employee Wellbeing Council, we always want to center around the human. And so we're going to start things off with Proust-inspired questions. And the very first question we're going to ask you is, which talent would you most like to have?
This is a great question. I think I wish I could speak any language in the world just fluently. I would really love to be able to talk to people all over the globe in their like native language, the language they're most comfortable with. This may be colored by the fact that I'm struggling to learn a language right now, and I just wish I could talk to people in it already.
Which language?
Spanish. Yeah, I am half Puerto Rican, but never learned it growing up. So I'm trying to learn it now, which is much harder as an adult than as a kid. So I wish I was there already, and then I wish I could speak every language.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right, right? It adds a level of warmth and connection to be able to speak in someone's native tongue. Yeah. All right. The next question is, what would you like to be if you were to die and come back as a person or thing?
Oh, that's a great question. I think actually a dolphin. I really love traveling and exploring, but you can only explore so much of the ocean, and they get to like travel and explore all over the place. Plus, they're super social and playful, and it just seems like it'd be a really fun time being a dolphin and coming back and just getting to play and explore something new.
Wow. I had never thought of it from that standpoint, and you're absolutely right. Dolphins look like they're always having a blast, right? In their kind of like their communities that they also have and form, they definitely seem like a very social species. All right, so let's get into some questions with respect to your line of work. So we're living in an era where we're in rapid change, whether it's AI transforming work or shifting workplace expectations, or even just the increasing complexity of leadership. This requires changing cultures. But when we hear the word culture all the time, it can mean different things to different people. How do you define workplace culture, and how do you make it more human-centered?
I think this is such an important question to start exploring. As we talked about, you hear culture all the time, and not a lot of people understand what that really means. I like to break it down to its basic elements so it doesn't feel as scary when we talk about needing to transform it based on all of these changes. Essentially, if you think about it, culture is defined by the behaviors that groups exhibit. And behaviors are driven by decisions that we make on a daily basis. So whether we're aware of them or not, we're actually making decisions almost countless times every single day. And they actually drive everything that we do. So when we talk about culture and changing culture, what we're really talking about is changing the criteria that we use to make decisions. And so if we think about it from that perspective, it can make it a much more easy conversation to have when we talk about how do you effectively change a culture and understand what your culture is. So if we think about culture as the decision criteria that we use, then we can start to think about how can you incorporate human-centered concepts into the decisions that we make every day, which then will impact the behaviors we do and then will create the culture that we're trying to create. Now, human-centered is such a general word also in and of itself. So I actually like to use a concept called human flourishing when I talk about this in terms of how to incorporate human-centered into your decisions that you make. And human flourishing is more like an outcome that you're trying to achieve, which can make it a little bit easier to use as a criteria. And in the very basic sense, human flourishing is the concept of helping people, both in your business and also the communities that you interact with, to holistically feel happy, healthy, and basically feel thriving in a sense of well-being. So if you can think about how you can incorporate human flourishing, creating this the opportunities for human flourishing into how you make decisions, you then will do behaviors that will help further that. And then you will create that culture within your organization and hopefully within the whole world, I think is what a lot of us are hoping for.
Yeah, I really love how you frame that, right? In terms of human flourishing, that you're thinking about the outcomes already. And then you're kind of, from what I understand, kind of working backwards towards here's the outcome we want. We ultimately want flourishing and thriving employees within a workplace that are connecting with our customers, right? Our customers, that sense kind of that thriving abilities as well. Okay. All right. So, you know, in terms of you take neuroscience-based approaches in much of what you do from an organizational change perspective, what does the brain's response to uncertainty tell us about why so many transformation efforts fail?
Yeah, so how I talked about culture and relating to all behaviors based on decisions that we make in our brain, it also is tied to the way in which we respond to change. And other criteria are different functions that occur within our brain that is tied to your amygdala. Uncertainty is actually a trigger that causes a threat response within your brain. Our brains do not like not knowing what's coming. They very, very much like understanding certainty and knowing what's coming. And change, by any other word, is essentially uncertainty. So what that actually does in your brain is it triggers your survival instincts, which we know of as fight, flight, freeze, fawn. I'm sure a lot of us are familiar with those terms. And when that happens in your brain, you're not in a place where you can be creative and thoughtful. Your executive functioning actually starts to shut down a little bit so that you can respond to this threat to your survival. Now, that's not very helpful when we're talking about uncertainty faced in social situations, because we're not actually talking about someone trying to kill us or an animal trying to eat us, which is really what the survival instinct is about. So it's important for us to think about different ways in which we can decrease that sense of uncertainty and increase the reward mechanisms within your brain so that you are no longer in a survival response and you're able to think creative, openly, and start problem solving. Now, the way that you can do that with uncertainty is to create more certainty, but that's not always easy to do. Certainty is not always available when we're talking about social changes, and especially when we're talking about changes within organizations. And so other ways in which you can help address and create that reward response is actually around four other triggers that also help increase this reward. It's called status. So basically, people care about how they are perceived in relation to other people. And so helping making sure people understand where they are within the organization. Autonomy, people like to be able to control themselves and be able to control their own actions. So creating opportunities and spaces for people within transformations to feel a sense of control and be able to make their own decisions can also help increase their success of whatever change you're trying to create. And then relatedness. We all like to feel connected with each other. So when you can help connect and create a sense of bonding and relationships within your organization, especially during change and big scale transformations, that can help calm people's nervous systems down and allow them to be in that really open and encouraging space. And then the last one is actually fairness. We are very fair creatures from a neurological level. Our brain actually is very tied to this. There's like studies with monkeys about this. That's hilarious. If you don't know about it, look up the monkeys and the grapes experiment. Okay. It is hardwired into us that we want fairness. So also when you're doing these transformational changes, just think about how you can incorporate and be clear about how you're making decisions and how they are being fairly applied across the board to everyone within your organization. So the more transparent you are, the more fair the process seems. And so if you do all of those things, you can really help increase the chances of changes being successful because you're really driving it from how the brain's responding to it and allowing people to be open to what those changes entail.
That's great. So help me with the recap again, the four items that you had mentioned. I noted fairness at the very end, but the very first one was?
So it's actually an acronym called SCARF. It's a model that you can find online. It's SCARF is status for the S, certainty, yep, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And those are the five triggers that can help you be in like a reward state in your brain. But the opposite of them can also help create those survival and threat responses in the brain as well. So if you keep those five things in mind, it's really helpful to understand a lot of the human behaviors that we see in work and in any social situation.
Wow, that right there is a real nugget. We're going to have to include that in the book. Okay. So, you know, when we talk about leaders, they really like to focus on control and making sure that they're doing things in an efficient manner. And really performance-based metrics are very much key to how leaders also operate. But the best workplaces focus on trust and empowerment. What shifts do leaders need to make to create an environment where employees truly thrive?
That is the million-dollar question. I think it comes down to the fact that you, in organizations, as a leader, you are hiring people because you believe that they can do the job. No one hires someone thinking that they can't do it. And so it's really about trusting the reason that you brought them into your organization in the first place and stepping back and letting them do the job that you hired them to do. Your role is actually more to make sure that they have the space and the support that they need to do their work, not necessarily to tell them every single thing that they need to do every single minute of the day. And that can be a little bit scary, especially when there's new people that come into an organization. But that's really where you get the benefits of bringing in new voices and innovative ideas is by letting them do things potentially different than what you have seen before. And now how do you support your people to do the work that you hired them to do is a tricky question and really nuanced. I'll talk about one piece around how we can empower people to align to the things that they want to do. I firmly believe that people perform at their best when they are doing work that they care about and doing work that they enjoy doing. And so as a leader, one thing that I always like to do when you're helping at an individual level is to talk to your people about four different elements of their work. I like to get a sense of basically what gives you energy, what drains your energy, and then add in what are you good at, and then what do you want to learn? And those four things kind of feel like they're similar, but they can be very different in terms of I can be really good at something that drains my energy. But as a leader, if I don't know that, I might give someone work that is continually draining them and end up leading to burnout. An example of that is I am very good at data analysis because I'm very good at detail-oriented things. But if I do that for an extended period of time, I am so drained, I like cannot function. So I can't be doing that day in and day out or else it won't be able to be sustainable. If my boss doesn't know that, but they see my output as better than the rest of the team in that, they might continually to give me those projects. And then you end up with one team member who isn't being able to feel engaged and excited and instead burning out. But if I know as a leader that she's really good at data analysis, but she also loves to write things, then I can give her a balance of two different things where you get to write in some weeks and some days, and you also get to do data analysis and others when we need you because we need you for the team. But I'm also aware that that's a draining activity, and I'll make sure that while you're doing that, I'm giving you the space you need so that we're not piling things on top and you have the space to recharge. And so when you think about it in that sense, you as the leader are taking an active role in managing and leading your people, which I think a lot of leaders want, right? They want to feel useful. But at the same time, you're doing it in a way where you're just taking a step back to allow people to do the work that they want to do, and simply helping them balance the requests and the demands that are being placed on them by the organization and their team.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, as leaders, it's just really important to be very present and really understand kind of the dynamics of the team, right? And who's on your team and what kind of makes them tick and what drives them and what fills their cup, right? So it's important to like pay attention. And I know one theme that has come up a lot is around being intentional, like just being very intentional with like your words and how you encourage individuals. I think that's also key. So thank you so much for that, Sasha. Okay. So organizations spend months or even years perfecting strategy, but when the culture doesn't support it, things tend to fall apart. How do we help companies align their culture with their business goals?
Yeah, this is a really great question. We hear the quote all the time, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I think that is very true. As leaders, it is super important to truly understand what your culture is before you can even think about how to align a strategy or even create a strategy to it. One of the most common things that I see across everybody that I work with is there is always a disconnect between the understanding of leaders who create the strategy, right, and the actual lived experience and culture that is within their organization. Every time I do a survey, there is always a pretty big difference between what the leadership, how the leadership answers, and then how people across different parts of the company answer. And so before you even get into doing strategy for your organization, it's important to understand where you are now and where people are in terms of their culture and their feelings. So how they believe and think about what they are doing and the behaviors that they are exhibiting, right? I talked earlier about culture is about the behaviors, which are then driven by the decisions that you are making. So before you dive, and strategy is driven by decisions. So before you can dive into strategy, you need to understand the criteria that your people are using and the processes that they are using to make decisions, which then is shown through their culture. And so my suggestion to do that is to actually go down into places you don't normally touch within your leader, within your organization, and ask people about their experiences, observe and get a better sense about what is truly happening within your organization, how people are truly working and functioning. And only in that way will you understand where the differences might be between how your company is actually running and the strategy you're trying to implement for your company. You can't implement a strategy if you don't understand how different or what types of changes it is. And you can't help your organization implement the strategy if you don't know what behaviors need to change to let you do it. So it all goes back in the end to decision-making, which I know is everyone's favorite topic as leaders. But in the end, it really does all come back to the criteria that everyone is using to make decisions and understanding really deeply what that is like within your organization.
Thank you. Yeah. Again, I mean, it's also like paying attention, right? And just having that kind of that pulse and making sure you understand what's going on. So you mentioned something earlier around it's important to kind of have those conversations, right? Like to speak to folks, see how they're kind of, I guess, interpreting the strategy that's flowing down, right? And maybe adjusting accordingly. Okay. So at this time, I mean, Sasha, we've come out of the pandemic now, and we're now in these hybrid work environments, which sometimes can be a little bit challenging. What do you believe are the biggest mistakes leaders are making when it comes to creating a high trust, high performance environment in a distributed workforce?
Yeah. So. When it comes to hybrid and remote environments, I think it's really important not to use the same techniques, management style, and practices that you used when you were in person. I think the biggest mistake that I see is during COVID, when everyone was forced to go virtually, people just took what they were doing in person and started doing them over the computer. And that was fine. We all had to do it. We had to make adjustments. But that is not actually how you get the biggest benefit from working in different environments and different structures. In the end, it's really important to think about the unique ways and benefits that you get from working in person, which is building deeper connections, being able to brainstorm and think bigger picture, doing some strategy stuff is really helpful to do in person because it lets you kind of build on the energy and grow and be really dynamic in how you are trying to figure out and challenge yourselves. But then also think about what's best for you to do virtually, which honestly is a lot of focused individual work and really tactical work that you're trying to execute. Understanding what those are can then help you figure out how you need to structure your work so you can get the benefits of both of those settings. Specifically, I want to put a call out of virtual work. So we know we're seeing all this return to office pushes because they're not seeing benefits and successes in virtual settings. A lot of that is tied to the fact that they weren't actually doing good virtual work practices. When I say good virtual work practices, what exactly do I mean? I'm talking about asynchronous work practices. So this is about asynchronous is when you are not doing an immediate interaction where if I talk, you immediately can talk back to me. There's some sort of a delay in terms of when I communicate something and when you communicate something back. Examples of that are texts, shared documents, anything that you share information in written form. And that is really what you should be prioritizing using when you are working virtually, because it frees up the time for people to be able to work, flexible schedules, flexible hours, and to have the focus time to really think about and document what you're trying to do. When you do this, it also allows people to think more deeply about things and allows you to get better outcomes when you actually do them effectively. So an example that I like to use around this is a lot of times we'll have a meeting and the first 20 minutes of the meeting will be someone sharing out a deck. And then the next 20, 30 minutes will be people talking about that deck. I always challenge people that for that part where you're just talking and sharing out a deck, do that asynchronously. Either share the actual slides, share the actual document, share whatever it is that you're presenting out. Ask people to read it ahead of time. Give them time to read it. Think about it as much as they need to. If someone wants to read it a whole day ahead of time and really digest on it, they can. If someone wants to scram reading it right before the meeting, they can, but really ask your people to read it beforehand. And then your whole conversation in that meeting where you're sitting all together in one room at one exact period of time can be the conversation, because that's really the benefit of being in synchronous conversations, which is meetings and like in-person talking. And so really focus your efforts there instead of making everybody sit through seeing and digesting content in person at the same time. Because the problem is that some people need longer times to think about what they're experiencing and what they're reading. Not everyone can hear something, digest it, make meaning, and then be able to actively engage in a conversation in real time. Some people need space and the ability to really reflect on it over time. So really, that's what I mean when I talk about how you need to structure virtual work to get the benefits of it. Once you do this, you actually can see a lot of benefits from a managerial perspective. We talked before about empowering people. A lot of people are concerned about how you do that in virtual settings. But when you do these asynchronous work processes, it actually becomes very clear who's doing the asynchronous work and who's not, which then as a leader allows you to have those more targeted conversations to support people and see how you can better engage them in the things that you are trying to do. So there's actually a lot of benefits about built-in documentation, things of that nature. I'm not even getting into the benefits of AI when you're doing digital work about actually being able to summarize content, but there's a lot of benefits to virtual work that we just need to focus and tease out before actively rejecting it overall.
Yeah, I love how you're really highlighting that there's different ways to come and address the virtual work environment so that you're able to kind of make it more effective, right? And then the asynchronous communication is really very key to this. Yeah, I think it's Jeff Bezos and his team that also, you know, they believe in developing memos. They don't do PowerPoints, and they make sure that they take time to read. I don't know if they do it in advance, but they take time, I think, during the meeting to read the memos and then discuss. But I really value what you're saying, because yes, everyone has a different way of absorbing the information and then being constructive with their feedback. So that's key. Okay, most organizations focus on financial and operational metrics, but those don't tell the full story. What human-centered indicators should leaders be paying attention to if they truly care about long-term success?
We run into this all the time, right? What you measure is what you reinforce and how you structure your organization. So if we're talking about creating human-centered organizations that allow for human flourishing, right? We have to be thinking about ways in which we can track and measure what people are doing. The challenge is, though, the concepts related to human flourishing or well-being in general are not easy to document and can sometimes feel very invasive to try to document. So I actually suggest from a leadership perspective to be taking track and trying to focus on various different elements. Some include mental and physical health and how much your team is resting. You actually can learn this through conversations. So how many times have you heard your team say, oh my gosh, I am so tired. I like barely got any work. I was rushing to get this project out. Do you hear that all the time? If you do, then you might need to take a second and check how your work is allowing people to take time to rest, because they're telling you that they are having some challenges in something related to their health. In addition, like, you want to think about retention and creativity, and there are all different ways in which you can think about what this looks like. Retention is easy. Are people leaving your organization? If people are leaving your organizations, there is something there that is not helping them thrive, which is relevant to human-centered organizations, right? We want everyone to feel like they can thrive continually within our organization. But creativity is actually a different piece of it that people don't really talk about all the time. A lot of time people leave organizations because they feel stuck and they feel like they aren't able to explore, expand, grow. And so one of the things I like to actually measure within organizations, a little bit easier to measure this one actually, is how much free time do you build into your teams? How much free time do you build in for people to just do something that they want to do that might be a crazy idea, that might be exploring this one thing that came up in a meeting that nobody was really able to have the time to run down, but you're like, oh, that might be really cool. Like, how much time do you free up and dedicate so that people have space to be creative? Creativity takes space. So that's actually one that you can actually measure a little bit easier. And then there's obviously the ones like psychological safety, measuring and being aware of how people are expressing how they feel in your organization. For leaders, I always say the easiest way to track this without being invasive by asking someone every day, how do you feel? How do you feel? Although there are surveys like that that are very effective. It just depends on your culture, how willing people will be to share that. But if people aren't willing to do those sanity checks, how are you feeling today without the organization? As a leader, you can check out in on them and see, are people expressing emotions at work? One of the best ways to identify psychological safety is if people are expressing negative and or positive emotions in work. If you are feeling like you can express emotions during your workspace, you feel like you're in a psychologically safe space, because most of the time in work, we consider emotions to be unprofessional. We know that that's not true. We know that people are humans. We experience emotions. Emotions are a part of everything that we do. So if you are creating a space where people feel safe, they will be expressing emotions to you or to others within your group. So really, it's about kind of paying attention to some of these everyday indications of how to measure the human side of your organization, tied with a couple like hard metrics that you can use as well to kind of use as a lightning point to kind of decide where you need to focus within your organization to learn a little bit more. But it is a tricky question that I don't think we're going to have answers to anytime soon. But it is one that we need to start exploring, because again, what you measure is what you put your resources in. So until we can find a strong way to measure it, these anecdotal ways are tried and true.
Yeah, thank you for that. And yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, once you put some focus around things, right, then you're starting to better understand how to track, like, how are you performing? How is your team kind of responding to things? And do shifts need to happen? The other thing that I think I really appreciate is the piece around space, right? Like, creating that space as well. Okay. So we're actually, you know, you touched on it a little bit earlier, briefly, the AI piece, right? Like, AI right now is prevalent. It's something that everyone's talking about. And AI adoption in particular is really changing the landscape of work. What's the best way to help people move through their fear and embrace change as it relates to things like AI?
Yes. So I just talked about emotion, and so I'm going to get back to that. Change causes emotional responses in people, the same as we talked about with survival instincts earlier in the session. The amygdala is also responsible for your emotions. And so when you are in change and you're in periods of uncertainty, which your brain considers a threat, it is triggering different emotions within your brain. Change also, in addition to the threat response, also creates a sense of, it triggers a series of thought patterns in your brain that is similar to actually death. So we all know actually that if someone dies in your family, that there's a process that people go through, right? Denial, anger, bargaining, depression. That same emotional response actually happens to all change. It isn't just death. Justice is a very extreme form of change, right? It's a human being was in your life and is no longer there. Any change elicits that same emotional response. It just takes different amounts of time for you to process through it. So if you want to help people decrease their responses to these big changes that are happening, you have to recognize that they will be experiencing these emotions, and there's nothing that you can do that will stop them from experiencing it. Your role is to make it so that they can go through it as quickly as possible, and it can decrease the amount that it impacts their performance. The best way to do this, there's a model called the change curve that you guys can look up. It's wonderful. There's a lot of leadership techniques that are tied to that. I use it all the time with my clients. But essentially, it also goes back to the brain that I was talking about in terms of finding ways as you are adjusting and changing to try to trigger the reward areas in the brain to show that the change isn't bad, it isn't scary, it's okay, and help move people through the denial, anger, bargaining, depression stages of change. And you do that through, again, the status, certainty, autonomy, related, and fairness. Make people feel good across those spectrums. Do things that make them feel better. When it's talking about change, we are talking about,
It looks like it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I know there was a little bit of a glitch there. Okay. That's fine. We'll edit it out.
I'll make a note of it.
32 minutes.
Okay. And I'll just pick up, you guys can cut something around that. What was I saying? Emotions to change. Yeah. And so you will be expressing these emotions to change. Being able to balance what that is, so denial, anger, bargaining, depression, you basically want to make sure that you are increasing people's reward feelings by helping them feel like they have autonomy within the change that is happening with them, that they are feeling connected, related to the people around them, and that is fair. So increasing transparency, increasing the amount you're communicating the change. In addition to that, there's actually a trick that you can use to also help people adapt to changes, especially when we talk about AI and different sorts of things about how and tools that we use in organizations. And that is actually tied to the autonomy trigger that I've been talking about. People want to feel like they are in control. So they respond really negatively when they feel like a change is imposed upon them. And especially when changes are imposed upon them that are forever, that are like long-term changes. If I do this and I say I'm okay with this, it is my new future. One technique you can use as a leader is to actually start to use things that are quick experimentations of these new behaviors to help decrease how scary they seem. So what I do with my clients a lot is I identify a change. Let's talk about an AI adjustment. Say you're going to be using an AI agent for hiring. A lot of people are starting to do that now, right? Your recruitment team might be really scared about what that means for them, their jobs, their impact. And so what you can do is try it out for an experimental period of time that is short. So say for 1 week or 2 weeks, we're going to use this to do this part of what we are doing. And then at the end, we will get together and talk about how we felt like that went and how we felt like it helped us or didn't help us. And then we'll tailor the ways in which we interact and engage with this AI agent to make it more beneficial for what we are trying to do. When you do those sorts of things, people are more willing to try out the new behaviors because it's just for a week or two. And then if I hate it, I can tell them about it and we can make adjustments and it's not forever. So I'll actually give it a try. Doing these sort of things really does decrease the amount of fear and resistance that you can see within your teams, but only if you actually listen to their feedback at the end. They'll buy in the first time. If you ignore their feedback, they won't buy in the second time. But if you actually listen to their feedback and make adjustments every time you do an iteration of these changes that are going to be happening constantly, you get a lot less fear and resistance in response.
Wow. That's such a great point to make, right? And really, I mean, I think it really boils down to also kind of addressing the change with a certain level of respect for your team, right? That you respect and value their feedback, and that you're going to, as a team, you're going to arrive at a decision together. You're going to analyze the data, because, you know, we all love data, and then make the necessary adjustments based on the information. All right. Well, we're nearing the tail end of our conversation. And Sasha, for leaders listening today who want to build a culture of human flourishing, right? Your word, but don't know where to start. What are some practical steps they can start to take today?
Yeah, so as we talked about with culture change, it is about behavior change. And I suggest that all leaders start that with yourselves. When we're talking about recentering the human side of things and trying to create the opportunity for humans to flourish, that's a big change. And so what I suggest is that you develop a practice to try out using creating human flourishing as a decision criteria for the decisions that you make in your role as a leader. Try it out next time you have a decision. Be like, okay, how is this going to help me center the human? How is this going to help me create human flourishing? Whichever criteria you want to use. Do it, make a decision, see what happens, see what action comes out of it, and then reflect on what that was like, how that experience was for you. Once you start to refine what is the right criteria for you to use for you, your business, and the culture you're trying to create, that's when you want to start reviewing how you make decision processes within your organization so that you can understand where you might need to shift it or where you might need to integrate it and how big of a change it might be for your organization depending on how they are currently making decisions. Like, are they only currently making it based on productivity measures? Then being like, hey, how are we going to help create human flourishing? It's going to be a big change because it's less concrete than productivity measures, right? And then you want to help your team and your organization start to make those adjustments. So start with yourself, identify what the change actually is, and then start to integrate the change. And most importantly, continue to reinforce it throughout your organization, because changing culture is about changing your decisions. And you make, like I said, you make millions of decisions a day. A lot of them are subconscious. So until you practice including some of these criteria and the ways you make decision in your conscious decisions enough over enough time so that it becomes subconscious, you're not actually changing your culture. And honestly, that's why culture change is really difficult, because it's a very long-term process and it's a lot of reiteration and reinforcement. But yeah, that's basically where I would suggest you start. Is start with yourself, baby steps, and then build up from there. Don't try to start at the end, because trust me, that'll be really, really hard.
So lead by example, and then others will follow, right?
Okay. Yes.
So very last question, Sasha. If we can roll back time and go back to your early 20-something self, what piece of advice would you give your younger self? What would it be?
Ooh. I think I would tell her to dream big and not to be scared of it. Lean in and dream big, I think.
That is fantastic advice, right? Because why not? Because why not? We're living in an era where I think more and more women have the ability to explore options. So why not, right? And it's wonderful leaders like, you know, I'm always in awe of leaders like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who just so eloquently and fiercely, you know, really fought for our rights so that as women, we can flourish, I think, in this era, right? It's not completely equal. It's not 100% there, but it's getting there. It's getting
much better than where we were when she was growing up, right? So that's only progress every day. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, it's an absolute pleasure speaking with you, Sasha. Thank you so much for your insights, your energy that you're bringing to the council. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for doing these conversations. It's really great to share, learn, and amplify each other's voices as we're trying to make these big changes in the world.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.